The subject of our meeting this afternoon is financial markets in the state, which is a follow-up on my lecture yesterday on the financial markets in the free society. This covers one part of my current research project, which concerns the political economy of finance. The relationship between production and finance is something that is particular to the Austrian school. Austrians have, at least since the times of Bauwerk, have stressed this, and within the mainstream there's always been the tendency to separate these two things into distinct realms. Right? So in the 19th century, one of the problems of economic teaching was the separation of real economics, which concerned the pricing process in a barter economy, from the teaching of money and credit, which was a completely different course, was separated. And we have the same kind of separation today. So we have money and banking classes, which are usually taught without context of, without relation to microeconomic foundations or even to the theory of production. It's completely different things. So Austrian economics is very interesting in that respect already. So even if you're not, for other reasons, an Austrian economist, for that reason alone, it's a very interesting paradigm because it brings these things together. So I hope to develop this a little further, and I've been working on the theory of capital, and currently, for a while already, I've been looking more into financial markets and thought about ways how to bring those into purview of the Austrian school. And it seems to me that, indeed, the currency school tradition is very important in that respect too. Well, today, I will simply my intention is simply to highlight the fact that empirically, the situation that we find on financial markets does not bear much resemblance to the treatment that financial markets receive in most textbooks. The textbook treatment of financial markets presents them as intermediaries between savers on the one hand and then the users of savings on the other hand, which are firms and households to some extent. And that is, of course, it's correct, but the impression that you get is that financial markets essentially make a contribution to the market economy by financing production. And if we look at this empirically, this is not, it's not the case, but I mean the relative weights are different. So what we see indeed is that financial markets also finance firms, but they, to a very large extent, finance consumption. Consumption either directly in the form of consumer expenditure or consumption in the form of government expenditure. And we have to put some question marks even behind the firms that are being financed, because very often financial intermediaries are run by governments. So I would first of all like to walk you some of this evidence, right? What I call also government dominance over financial markets, and then look at the different techniques that governments have used and are still being using to exercise this dominance. So we have financial market interventionism. Of course, the predominant aim of financial market interventionism is to provide resources to the government. And this is done both directly to facilitate government expenditure, but also indirectly, so funding those projects that are dear to the government, but which it cannot finance or does not wish to finance out of its official budget. And then we'll conclude very, very briefly. Okay, a few elements of evidence. I've looked at way financial savings are being used. So we have financial savings, we have also real savings in the form of real estate, most notably. Right? And then we have cash savings, although cash savings also fall within financial savings in our current statistics. And of course, I rely on the statistics because I cannot make them on my own. Right? So I will maybe say a few words later on about statistics. So we have here the different sectors, right? These data you find very easily in national accounting. So this is taken from the Statistisches Bundesamt, and you find the same thing, I guess, also on Eurostat. In France, it would be INSEE. In the United States, it's typically the Federal Reserve, the Board of Governors, that has such data, sometimes also the Bureau of Economic Analysis. So we find here for households and non-profits, we find so the total volume of financial assets held by households and non-profits, which were 4.4 trillion euros in 2009. And on the other hand, we have liabilities and equity. So in the case of households, of course, it's no equity because we don't have a slave economy. In a slave economy, you could hold equity in households, could be a shareholder of a household. But so in the case of households, this applies only to firms, right? To non-financial corporations and to financial corporations. It does not apply, it also applies to the rest of the world, does not apply to households and governments. Right? Households and governments have no equity, it's only debt. So what kind of debt is essentially real estate, credits, right, and consumer credit. Real estate is about 1.1, 1.2 trillion euros, and the rest is consumer credit. Okay, so financial corporations, non-financial corporations, of course, here we have the inverse picture. You see, of course, they have liabilities and equity, 3.9 trillion. This is what we expect, right? So financial markets are supposed to finance corporations. But they also hold a significant part of financial assets. Where does this come from? Well, the sector non-financial corporations includes also holding companies. Okay, so that is one thing. Plus, even non-financial corporations that are not holding companies very often hold some financial instruments to park, so to say, resources that they cannot presently use in their firm. And financial corporations, of course, very big. We see that here assets and liabilities are approximately the same, which reflects the fact that their corporations are, well, financial intermediaries. So not financial corporations are financial intermediaries, right? So they don't use those resources themselves. They transmit them, essentially. And then government, of course, there are liabilities that are important. These liabilities do not reflect all financial obligations, of course, that governments have. For example, the French government owes me a lot of future payments. There's already obligations that we know now, right? So they owe me if I survive, right? A salary next year, the year after, and so on, till retirement, and even a retirement. So the financial obligation that we know now is not reflected here, right? And there are other financial obligations resulting, for example, from a public pension scheme or from public health system and so on, is also not reflected in this figure. And then we have the rest of the world, which in the case of Germany is an important position. You see here that Germany has a net negative position, that is the liability and equity of the rest of the world in Germany is higher than the financial assets of the rest of the world in Germany, so which means that Germany is net financing the rest of the world, right? So foreigners hold for 4.4 trillion euros shares and own debt instruments issued by German residents, but they themselves has issued to German residents shares and other financial titles that have been bought by Germans. So this figure is higher. So the Germans are net payers to the rest of the world. And then we get a total. The total should, ideally, the total the two totals should be the same, right? Because everybody's assets, one person's asset is necessarily another person's liability, right? Because here we have all sectors, all possible sectors, so it's a mutually inclusive accounting system, so it should net out, and the total of financial assets should be exactly equal to the total of financial liabilities. So why is it not the case here? Well, because you always have some errors, right? So, because the data sources are different, and so you never get to the situation where it nets out perfectly. Okay, which brings me to one observation. Yeah,
I'm sorry. It's the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So the 4.8 mm-hmm. Under the liability and equities. Mm-hmm. That is the assets owned by the German assets owned by the rest of the world.
No,
that's a German liability.
No, that's assets issued by the rest of the world held by Germans.
Okay. Okay. Because the rest of the world is the one that is reversed.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it must be. It always nets out, and the two figures must be the same. So one observation for empirical work, this looks credible. Right? Whenever there's some error, it's credible. And you know that it's probably they've not massaged the data too much. In the case of the French data, it's always exactly, it's the exact zero, right? It's exactly the same thing. So you know there's something fishy. I mean, these guys probably, they screw up too, right? But they do it less blatantly, right? And in the U.S., you have quite a... For example, in the U.S., you have... the totals are $151 trillion, so it's much more. And the error margin is quite huge. I think it's something like $3 trillion or so. It's a very substantial sum. But this is credible, right? So I guess they are faking some of the data too, but they're doing it professionally. Okay, so this looks okay, right? I mean, so could be true. Okay, so we can then calculate a net position for each of them, and then we get the picture that we expect, right? So households and nonprofits are positive, right? They are net savers, net financial savers. And non-financial corporations are net users of savings, the government, of course, as well, and the rest of the world as well, right? And the plus 69 is just the error that we have in the accounting. Okay, then what I did then is to calculate the percentage provided and consumed of total net financial savings. So I've added up the 2,902 saved by the households and the 247 saved by financial corporations. It gives us a total of 3,149. So this is the total available financial savings, net savings. Okay, who are the net users of this? Well, it's again non-financial corporation, government, rest of the world. So we can calculate a percentage. Right. So we see that non-financial corporations consume 47% of all savings. So this is the textbook case. Right? But as we see here in the case of Germany, it applies to only about half of financial markets. Right? And so roughly the other half is something that is also touched but is not really emphasized. And what we see here is that financial markets to a very large extent finance consumption, right? Consumption expenditure through governments. And the rest of the world. Rest of the world is essentially is foreign banks. That's what it is. Okay, if we do the same, so these are the data again for Germany. We can do the same thing for other countries. So I looked at other major financial centers. So we get these figures, for example, for the U.S., as you see, U.S. is the main textbooks apply better to the case of the U.S., right? So their non-financial corporations indeed absorb a greater part of all available financial savings. But again, government has a very substantive part, 27%. France, even more so, 66% is used by non-financial corporations, 34% by government. 10% is provided by financial corporations. Now, in the case of French data, we need to be careful, of course. Right, so this looks very good, right? The banks are really financing to a very large extent financial markets are financing firms. But again, we need to interpret the data correctly. Right? Which are the companies that rely on financial markets for financing? In France, it's very often it's companies that are very closely associated with political power, large industrial companies and others. Whereas truly private companies, one example would be the Michelin tire company. It's a family-owned business, also Peugeot. It's also very largely family-owned. They do not rely that much on financial markets. Michelin has very few debt, so especially hardly any debt in that company. Right? So the closer it is to government, then the larger tends to be also the reliance on financial markets for finance. And the case of France is significant also in that respect that banks are owned to a very large extent by the government and or controlled through financial regulation. The UK, we have this, 58%, so it's kind of similar to France, but UK is the lowest, the government is the lowest share, and in Japan it has the highest share. Right? So Japanese corporations, it's very fascinating figures, I found. Japanese corporations do not rely on financial markets very large. There's one another amazing figure that you have in the case of Japanese corporations. They own the volume of their assets is one third or so higher than the total volume of their assets, of their liabilities and equity. How can that be? Well, the answer is that they have reserves, right? So which are not negotiated by the public, right? So the corporations are really kind of fiefdoms, right, or little kingdoms that not control, hardly any control at all by financial markets, that rule themselves. And so they have no dependence as to the financial markets. Okay. Right, so we have governments, I mean, wherever you look, even in the Anglo-Saxon countries, right, USA, United Kingdom, government consume a substantive part of financial savings. And financial corporations, of course, consume also a large part of those financial savings, but again, very often because the financial intermediaries themselves are owned or steered through financial regulation by the government, it's also, we cannot exclude that it's also part of the political process, right? So it's not because we have this figure here that it's not necessarily part of government dominance over financial markets, right? One last piece of evidence that is interesting. I've listed here the different types of assets owned by euro area monetary and financial institutions, which here in this case, excluding the euro system, so without central banks, right? Including central banks, it's another $5 trillion or so. So what we see here is, right, again, is this interesting thing about this. Does this work? Nah, does not work.
It's working.
Yeah, it's working?
Yeah.
Ah, yeah, it is. Yeah, but it did.
Put it on there, it doesn't work.
Yeah, there it doesn't work, really, right? Like. Yeah, you see here, the claims on non-financial corporations are only 22%. This is amazing, right? Whereas claims on governments, okay, it's 8%. Households is 16%. Right? So households and government combined so it's consumer type claims, consumption type claims, is more than the claims on non-financial corporations. So what are the type of claims that banks hold as the financial intermediaries? Well, they hold especially claims on other banks. That's amazing. Even the claims on non-euro area residents, so these are American banks, right, and UK banks. So banks, to a very large extent, do business with themselves. Okay, and then there are some elements where they also make business with other people. Right. So that's the empirical fact, right? So we see, right, I mean, the textbook style financing of companies channeling savings to productive expenditure in firms, etc., does play a role, and even a significant role, but it's, one type of use among others, right? A very large chunk of all financial savings is not used productively. Sunk into government expenditure or household consumer expenditure. Which brings us to financial market interventionism. So what is financial market interventionism? I've a little attempt at a definition. If the general definition of in interventionism, an interventionist government commands private property owners to use their resources differently than they otherwise would have done. And financial market interventionism then does the same thing, but on financial markets. So it aims at improving the government's bargaining position vis-a-vis its creditors. That's not yet. I'm not yet perfectly happy with this definition because the definition relies on objective, which is difficult to identify in practice. But anyway, what are the main instruments that we have here in? That we use, I think these are the five main types of instruments. We have inflation, privileges for government financial firms, forced savings, forced lending to the state, and price rigging. Now, the particularity of the Austrians, of course, I mean, in the mainstream literature, you find elements, so books and articles on the last three. That is, especially on number four and number five. Number six is somewhat difficult, price rigging, and I'll discuss this a little bit. Difficult to pin this down. Is this really price rigging going on? It's difficult sometimes to distinguish a manipulation of a price from a regular intervention. What you don't find in most mainstream texts is the analysis of the role that inflation plays in financial market interventionism. And since you are familiar with the Austrian literature, I won't go into that much detail. I will just limit myself to saying that the main connection here runs as follows, right? That, of course, governments pursue the objective of facilitating government debt, government finance. And one avenue to do this has been to manipulate the monetary system. So they've put into place monetary institutions, most notably fractional reserve banks and also fiat money, that facilitate the extension of credit. And as we've seen empirically, governments are some of the main beneficiaries of credits, right? So they stand first in line to profit from this, therefore they've done this. Now, one of the unintended consequences, and again, I suppose it was an unintended consequence, though I don't know, right? But sometimes you don't know the intentions of people, right? I suppose it was an unintended consequence, but which has reinforced this, is that these monetary institutions, because they constantly inflate the money supply, have created an environment of chronic price inflation, and have therefore discouraged savings in the form of cash holdings. So this is the point that I also stressed yesterday. So it's no longer worth the while. In fact, it's suicidal to save in the form of cash. You've got to use your savings differently. You've got to buy some real estate or precious metals, shares, something, or some maybe debt instrument that provides you some return to compensate for the loss of purchasing power. And if you save in cash, I mean, you lose. That, of course, is a huge boon. It's a huge boon for financial markets. Because, again, empirically, before the advent of fractional reserve banking, central banking, fiat money, people would typically save in different forms. They would save in cash. So financial intermediation concerns, so to say, only the excess wealth of very rich people, or let's say moderately affluent people who look for other things. They have enough cash on hand, so they start looking for other things. They buy real estate, buy a second home, a third apartment or whatever, and then they also buy shares and government bonds and so on. Now, through the inflationary monetary system, you create the same incentive for everybody. Right? You don't do it as from whatever the $10,000 or so that you save. You do it right from dollar one. So you cover the whole mass of the population. And so this is a very powerful mechanism, I think, that has boosted the development of financial markets, has been completely neglected in the mainstream literature, has also been neglected in the Austrian literature. Okay, privileges for government financial firms. This concerns especially public banks and semi-public banks. In the U.S., private banking is, of course, prevalent. You have major public banks. The major public banks that you have in the U.S. Are real estate banks. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Right? So they have a combined balance sheet of something like $6 or $7 trillion. Right? So it's huge. But as compared to the overall credit market in the U.S., some $40 trillion, it's important, but it's not dominant. Right? So it's a very big thing. And otherwise, banking by and large is private, but of course it doesn't mean that it's outside of the purview, outside of the control of governments. Right? Governments always have some angle on it through financial regulation. Now, in other countries, this dominance over financial intermediaries is more direct. So in France, for a very long time, for example, the biggest banks were owned by the government, were nationalized. And then the socialist government of Mitterrand in the early 80s nationalized them again after some phase of privatization, and they were reprivatized again, 6 or 7 years later, at the end of the 80s. So we have now large so-called private banks in France, but next to it we also have public banking systems. Some of the largest banks are public. For example, the Caisse de Dépôt et de Consignation is a big public bank, has half a trillion euros of a balance sheet. And in Germany, the situation is very similar. In Germany, we have a three-tier banking system consisting of private banks, mutual or banking cooperatives. That's how they are called.
Mutual savings banks.
Mutual savings banks, yeah. Which are usually owned by the cities, so it's municipally owned. The municipal savings banks. That's the difference. That's the third tier. Yeah. No, but we are also something that resulted from the cooperative movement. It's very particular to Germany. You don't have this in the U.S.
But the depositors own the bank.
Yes.
That's mutual savings banks.
That's mutual savings banks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm. Even savings and loans. Some of them they're owned by.
Yeah.
The
yeah. Yeah. So here we have. Right, and in the last two tiers, the market shares is approximately, I mean, it has evolved very little in the course of time, so about one third. So two tiers of the German banking system are publicly controlled, not by the federal government, but by local and state governments. Right. And banking in continental Europe is much bigger than in the U.S., in the U.S., if you look at overall financial markets, what are the biggest biggest organizations? It's investment funds, right? And then bank comes second. So investment funds is more than $20 trillion. Banks have a total balance sheet of some $15 trillion. And in Europe, as you have seen before, right, total assets of monetary and financial institutions is €33 trillion. Which is something like $70 trillion. Well, something like $40 trillion. Yeah, $40 trillion. Right, so banking is huge, right? And if out of this, most of it is run or more or less directly controlled by government, so which it means that credit is politicized. I mean, that's what it means. What kind of things would they buy? Well, as we have seen, they buy a lot of government assets, but which companies do they finance? Well, you can imagine the kind of cronyism that's going on. Who gets the credit, under which conditions, and so on. It's a party comrade, and so on. Right? We have this constantly. So we have this. Then we have forced savings. Forced savings are especially important wherever you have a public pension system. It's a form of forced savings. You force people to save a part of their income that they might otherwise have consumed or invested in their own firm. So they say, well, you've got to pay it into the public pension system. In the best of all cases, it is really saved. That is, you have a public pension system based on the capitalization principle. Very often, public pension systems rely on a pay-as-you-go basis. That is, the savings that you have are entirely fictional, right? You have claims on the side of the households who have paid a lifelong into the public pension system, so they think, well, I have a right to certain payments, but in fact the money is gone, right? So there's no savings, no accumulation. But it's been forced savings that have been transmitted directly into the consumption of other people, so it's gone. Forced savings... So this is the most important case. Forced lending to the state can occur outright. For example, two weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, there was a paper issued. I think I mentioned this yesterday also in my lecture, right? One of the German public German research economic research institutions. So they published a paper making the case for a forced loan of Germans and also financial institutions to the government. Right, so you say, you take over part of the revenue, and if you cannot do this out of the revenue, well, you're forced to liquidate part of your other assets in order to buy the government loan. So this is an outright thing. It's, of course, very brutal. The last time we had something like this was after World War I. Right, so then, right, too, we had a big debt problem, and the government had been running deficits for a couple of years, and there was the printing press that had been used to finance public expenditure and so on, and interest rates were rising. So then, out of desperation, they resorted to such measures. Today, we do this even though we are not yet, by any historical standard, we're not yet in a critical state. I mean, everybody talks about a crisis. It's true, we have a crisis, but I mean, we don't have a mass of unemployed people roaming the streets, and there's no hunger and misery and so far, right? I mean, we'll probably get to this, but so far is nothing, right? I mean, this reflects just the increasingly feeble nerves of people, right? People become more and more hysteric, and so the sensitivity level decreases, so the slightest disturbance of things and people go nuts. And so here in this case, then, we're talking already now about such confiscatory measures. Other forms, or most forms of forced lending to the state are more indirect, and they come through, especially through financial regulation. Banks, but especially insurance companies, and also some investment pension funds and so on, are legally obliged to give to their assets a certain composition. For example, German insurance companies cannot legally invest more than 30% of their assets in shares. I don't know the exact figure that they have to invest in public in government debt, but there's some minimum that they have to invest there, allegedly because it's safe, right? Right, so this way too, right? I mean, you prevent that they would go to other assets, and right now the incentive would be very strong. And economically, in order to protect their clients, that's what insurance companies and pension funds should do, right? They should buy shares, and they should not buy bonds. It's very dangerous to buy bonds right now. Or maybe invest in real estate or something like this, but they may not.
Just one question came to my mind. For example, in Canada, we have something like registered education saving plan, like the RESP college. Is it the kind of forced lending to state as well? Do you see that?
Yeah, if it's legally mandated, yeah.
Yes, legally. Not legally mandated, but it's too much that tax deduction that you basically...
Ah, okay, so there are tax incentives to do this. And are they also subject to such regulations that force them to invest in certain classes of assets? Probably yes.
I'm not aware of that.
Yeah, so I don't know either. Right? But if this is the case, then yes. Right? And most of them are, in fact. Right? So this is not an accident. This is very systematic and pervasive. You have this in all countries. And then you have sometimes requests. Before I get to the request, another very important piece of financial regulation that pushes in the same direction are the Basel Accords, Basel Agreements, which I mentioned yesterday. So Basel Agreements provide for minimum capital equipment of banks, allegedly to make them more robust. But the capital requirements are risk-weighted, right? So according to the asset class in which they invest. Now, government-issued securities have systematically a zero risk weight, right? Systematically. In Basel I, which was in 1988, this held true for all governments, any government, right? So starting with Basel II, then banks were given somewhat more flexibility. They could apply their own methods in order to evaluate risk, so they could end up at the conclusion that maybe handing out more credits to the Greek government is not such a good idea because it might be risky or so. But in fact, there were very strong incentives to use the official ponderation weighting system, which gave a zero risk weight to those government bonds. Now we have Basel III, and in Basel III, it is possible, and you no longer have necessarily a strong incentive to apply a zero risk weight to governments that are excessively indebted, but you are authorized to apply a zero risk weight to your own government. That is, right? Even if, right, if you use financial notations and so on, they indicate, well, for example, now Italy was downgraded to whatever, triple C or something like this. So risk weight is relatively high, but if you're an Italian bank, then you don't, then you're allowed to ignore this completely, and you can apply a 0% risk weight to the bonds that you buy from your own government. Okay, so which means that banks can still expand in principle, can expand indefinitely their balance sheet if they buy debt from their own government.
Yeah. So it means that the banks, they are allowed to locally expand as much as they can.
No, I mean, it's not without risk. Right? I mean, but for example, of course, but if they have good reasons to believe that they will be bailed out if something goes wrong, yes, they could do this. Yeah.
I just want to add that Basel III also adds something like minimum liquidity provisions.
Right.
So banks must have very liquid assets, and liquid assets are cash and, of course, government bonds. Yeah. So they need to have money for.
Right. I mean, it's actually very funny if you look at these regulations and you come, let's say, from a rather free market perspective, and you see this is so blatant. And it's so blatant that the regulations are biased in favor, of course, of the guys who are making the regulations. Who's making the regulations? These guys. Yeah, and then third major technique is outright requests. That is, you don't have a law, but you have informal requests coming from the government, so you have kind of pressuring them, pressuring insurance companies in particular and banks to lend to the government. Well, they have a round table or whatever, they have an emergency meeting, whatever, in the Oval Office or where not, and say, friends, you've got to buy our stuff. Right? And this is what Spanish and Italian banks have done in the past 2 years, especially within the last 12 months. So they sold the assets that they held abroad, and therefore the euro didn't depreciate very much because there was pressure on dollar because they were dollar investments. They sold them and bought their own government's claims. Okay. Now, this is, of course, disastrous in many respects, right? Already from a very simple portfolio point of view, right? If you have portfolio theory, you should spread your risks and so on. Do not have all investments in one geographical area and one political area and so on. Spread it out, and now they're putting everything in their own country. So they have. It's like if you buy a pension or if you subscribe to a pension scheme from the firm where you're employed, right? It's not necessarily a good idea because your ordinary revenue, your salary depends on the firm, and then plus also now your financial future, right? Your pension payments, not necessarily a good idea. We're doing this right now on a massive scale. And then finally we have, there are other things as well, but I'll leave this out. And then finally we have things like price rigging. Now price rigging, we need to be careful, right? And, the price, of course, that we are thinking of immediately is the interest rate, right? So governments might, of course, they wish to have loans at interesting interest rates, but it would be counterproductive to impose a price ceiling, an official price ceiling on the interest rate. And this is something that we know from elementary price theory, right? If you, if your market, in this case, it's a credit market with loanable funds, supply and demand. Now the government comes and imposes a maximum price ceiling here, right? Then, of course, the intention is to have the same volume that they otherwise would have had. So before they contracted this volume, they had to pay this interest, and they find this interest rate is too high. But now what they get is not this volume at this interest rate, but rather the supply shrinks to this level. Okay, so this is the actual volume that the government gets. So it would be counterproductive. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, they've never done this. They're not stupid. So whereas they impose minimum price controls on all kinds of other markets, labor markets and so on, never the financial markets, especially on government bonds, because the result would be a dramatic shrinking of the funds available for government finance. So they don't do this. So what do they do instead? Well, they try to make life difficult in other segments of the financial markets. Right? So for example, they might interdict, and this is a great classic, they might say to banks, well, you may not pay interest on your demand deposits. It's one way for banks, especially in an inflationary period, when people might be reluctant to leave any money whatsoever on a bank account because they're losing. Right? So banks might start offering to pay an interest rate in order to attract deposits, because otherwise the rest of their business would collapse. Right? So then governments in the past very often said, well, you may not do this. We may not do that. Why would they want this to prevent this? Well, they want to take this alternative out of the game. Right? And so they make life difficult for savers in all other segments of the financial markets in order to narrow down the available alternative and make government debt appear relatively interesting. That's the point. Okay. For the same reason, they have an incentive, a very powerful incentive, to manipulate, for example, precious metals markets. Right? Why would governments, I mean, there's been a lot of writing, a lot of speculation, why would governments try to manipulate, for example, the gold market or silver market? And you get explanations like, the gold price is a reflection of the health of the economy, a reflection of the health of government finance and something like this. So governments, it's like a thermometer, right? So they want to keep this low. This is a very weak explanation, right? Because there are various other things that you just look at government accounts and you see they have huge debts. I mean, that doesn't look good. It's also kind of a thermometer, and still they don't get nervous about that. So I think the explanation is much more straightforward. Gold is an alternative investment for savers. It's an alternative way to protect you against a rising price level. And it's particularly interesting because gold is nobody's debt. So all other forms of financial assets are typically somebody's debt, and this somebody can go bankrupt, can default. Gold cannot default. It's just there. Right. So now if you make sure that the gold price doesn't develop very much, or that there are sudden collapses of the gold price, that is very volatile and so on, you make it uninteresting or relatively uninteresting from an investor's point of view. And therefore, you give stronger incentive for people to finally buy government bonds, which do not fluctuate that much. And, well, it's true. I mean, there are no sexy evolutions of the price level, but it's reliable, and there's some compensation against the interest rate. Now, I've been always very careful with such statements, believe me. But I've come across one piece of evidence in the past few months, and some of you might have seen it, some of you who read the financial press, which is just unbelievable. So I've got this up here for you. Oh, wait a minute, this is for savings. Come back on this. Forced lending. Yeah. Price rigging. Okay. I'll come back on this. Precious metals. Okay. This is the evolution of the overall gold price, okay, which is familiar to most of you, right? So spectacular evolution in the past 12 years. So it's a 600% increase from 2001. Now, if we look at the gold price evolution in the same time period during trading hours in the US, we get the following. So this is the evolution of the gold price for somebody who would have started buying in the morning of a trading day, held it until the evening, then sold his gold again, right, and starts trading the next day again. And so in the morning he has whatever, $100,000, he buys gold, sells all of this gold at the evening, at market closure. Next morning, with this sum, he buys gold again, and so on and so on. I mean, you would expect if you get this 600% increase that by and large it wouldn't matter when you buy. But in fact, what we observe is that the gold price during trading hours has decreased 70%.
Wait, during a particular day?
No, this is all days. It's the guy who sat down and just
really?
Just looked at all the data. He looked at, right, you have the morning fix and, yeah. and the afternoon fix thing. So he took the morning fix, the price, and then the afternoon fix for all days.
It's cumulative.
Yes, cumulative.
Cumulative drop over
right,
the days
right.
between those.
So the same person, okay. right, there's one guy who buys, let's say, January 1st, 2001, in the morning, he buys his gold and just puts it into the hole in his garden or whatever, and then 11 years later it's worth six times the initial sum. So he has invested $100,000, he has $600,000. His friend has the same amount of money and he is a day trader. He buys in the morning, sells in the afternoon, so should be dying by and large do just as fine. He loses, he has $30,000 at the end. This is crazy.
But isn't there some incentive to do the reverse?
Yeah, sure, of course. This is a very strong incentive now to arbitrage, right? I mean, to play this. So this is, I mean, it raises a lot of questions. I mean, but that's the fact. I mean, you cannot get around the fact. This is amazing. Yeah.
So is it true that the gold is a wealth of reach, that you can hold the gold for a long time, you cannot trade it? Is it inferring that?
No. There's a gold. You can buy and sell gold anytime. It's one of the most liquid assets.
I know. Right? You should be rich to hold the gold for a certain time, like a year or two or three, to get that amount.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's the implication, right? But you should not.
Not with a small
you should not day trade in the U.S. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's implication, right? But so, I mean, if there was during day trading times in the U.S. 70% decrease, of course, it must mean that during the rest of the 24 hours, right, in other markets of the world, you must have even higher profits, right? And so the question is indeed, as Philip raises, why is there no arbitrage? I have no answer. I mean, but this is the fact. This is just amazing. So this comes as close as it gets when you want to demonstrate market manipulation. There is something very fishy here. Yeah.
So why is it that only the US is manipulating markets like that? Do you have more experience on that or something?
I have no idea. I cannot answer. I mean, but what we know is, right, I mean, what we know is governments have an incentive to do this. And the incentive is differently strong, and maybe the determination to do something of this sort is different in different countries, right? So this raises also a lot of questions, right? So why only the U.S.? Why is there no arbitrage and so on? But I mean, we have an explanation for this. We don't have an explanation why is it only in that market. I don't have one. Yeah.
Can we imagine this scenario? Let's say the first of the day, you know, gold comes to market. Somebody with a US dollar cash or whatever, you know, buy the gold at the end, you know, it goes down. But overall in the world, it goes up. I mean, is it the kind of probability that there's lots of gold buying by day?
No, during the U.S. trading hours, you have the world gold market, right? There are no different prices. It's the same price. There's one price, right? Let's say right now we are trading hours, so the gold price is whatever, $1,600. It's the same price in Moscow, same price in New York, same price in Paris, same price everywhere. There are no price differences during the trading hours. The evolution comes as soon as they close shop in the U.S. Around 4 o'clock or something, or even right now I think it closes actually at 3. New York time, so we're past that, right? Yeah.
So you're saying that when you're close to 3 o'clock, the price could just go drops?
Yeah, that's what.
On a daily basis.
Yeah. Not every single day, right? But yeah.
Have I understood you correctly? You said how it's being manipulated?
No. No, we just see here. I mean, this is the smoking gun. Right. I mean, this is not normal. I mean, this is just amazing.
The suggestion is not that the manipulation takes place by any extra market means. The suggestion is that they have a lot of bears, right? under services, right? Who short it?
Well, I mean, the techniques that they use are different. For example, I mean, one reason why the U.S. government can do this and other governments cannot is because the U.S. government controls a lot of gold, the biggest gold stock in the world. And there's some speculation that they've sold most of it, but okay, it's a different story. But officially, they have the biggest gold stock in the world, and by far. And so there are a few others who could do this. The second biggest gold stock is actually in Germany, but the Germans actually don't control their gold. Most of the German gold is in the U.S. and in England. So, right, if you take this into account, then right, the German-U.S. gold stock combined is what a 4 or 5 times higher than the next 5 or 6 gold owners combined. So that's a big market power. Right? I mean, so they could do this.
Maybe they don't. I know it's a lot of German gold is at the New York Fed.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you mean they don't control it? I mean, they can't send orders to the Fed.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
Okay.
So they engage in swap agreements and so on. Right?
The Fed has probably discouraged them from doing certain things that didn't like.
From redeeming it. Yeah. There's never any question of getting this back.
Was this taken from Germany after World War II?
No. This gold stock has emerged in the 1960s in particular. And Germany had big balance of payment surpluses with the U.S., so they settled in gold. And they said, well,
they put it in, they
but
defend it.
We don't ship it.
They put a different bin, more
German. Whereas the French, they send warships and they recovered. They knew what they had to send. If they had just sent a commercial liner, I mean, that would have sunk, probably. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Okay, so what other forms of price rigging? So we have financial derivative trading, right? So you can try to influence spot prices through the derivative markets. Forex interventions is a little bit neglected. Many traders don't see this connection, but foreign exchange rates are not as it usually, I mean, the kind of stupid commentary that you get in the press is always, yes, it's good or bad for exports and imports. But the main connection is actually the interest rate. If you invest in a currency zone and the exchange rate goes down, I mean, well, however much of an interest you earn on your investment in local currency, I mean, you can lose all of this through the exchange rate. And so exchange rate stabilization is very, very important. If there are major fluctuations in the exchange rate, you get major disruptions of capital flows. So, right, the intervention that is taking place aims at, in the case of Forex intervention, at stabilizing the exchange rate, right, sometimes at unrealistic levels. Controlling the inflation rate is also a form. Now, how can you control the inflation rate? One way is simply through manipulation of the way it's calculated. Right? I would say manipulation is maybe harsh, right? Changes of the methodology or how you calculate it. And, there's this guy that I mentioned already yesterday, William Williams, right, who runs Shadow Stats.
Yeah.
So he applies the traditional methodology and says, well, the new methodology underestimates the inflation rate systematically by in between 3 and 4%, something like this, or 3 and 6 or something. So the real inflation rate by the 1980s methodology that we have now is way higher than the 3%. That we have. Now, why is this important? Well, it's of course important because the interest rate contains the price premium. So if the inflation rate is higher, then you want to be compensated for the loss of purchasing power. So it's very important to control the inflation rate. So you have these techniques, and then some of the changes that they did was to introduce the principle of hedonic pricing. Another thing they did was to... The weighing of the right, we have now a chained inflation index, right? You don't no longer have a fixed basket, but the basket is changing every year, which is of course you have of course outright lies in certain cases, right?
But why is the I am I know about Shadowstats, but why do you think the interest of the inflation rate is so high, even in face of that most money is stuck in the financial system? Because most money is at the moment just in the financial system, it doesn't access the markets. So do you think it's just that people are anticipating that at some point, because of all this quantitative easing, that people are already raising prices, or where do you think it's coming from? Because it's the only thing what enters the market is like money expansion of the government, which is not that much compared to the overall economy.
Well, first of all, money is not, strictly speaking, it's not bound up in financial markets. Right? I mean, financial markets do absorb some money because you need cash balances for the transactions. Right? But the financial markets per se do not absorb cash. Right? Then, I mean, we do have, I mean, if you talk to any American consumer, any American housewife or so, I mean, she will tell you that prices have increased quite significantly, and it doesn't show up neither in the official inflation statistics, and you do not quite see it if you look at only at money supply, money aggregates. There has been some inflation, but it's not dramatic. I think much of it comes from a reduced demand for dollars, on the side of Americans, but also especially on the side of foreigners, right? Many dollars traditionally have been, much of the American money supply has been held outside of the country. Now, this is now streaming back. So in the statistics, you don't see it because the money supply is still the same as before. Only before it was held outside, now it's coming back. So prices go up.
Just to give you a figure, that's 67% of supply of U.S. currency is held outside in value terms.
Yeah, plus right now we don't know exactly.
80% of $100 bills are held outside the country. Yeah. Now, we don't know what's going to happen. That was a study done a while ago. It could be flowing back, as you point out.
Mm. Isn't that because of drugs?
Drugs, black markets, hedging against inflation in certain countries, smuggling, so on and so forth.
Mm. Various reasons. Yeah. One other way to control the inflation rate is by controlling strategic commodities such as oil. And here too, the U.S. is very well positioned because the U.S. is a major oil producer in the world, and there are major oil reserves that have not yet been tapped, right? But could be. And so there's constant. Sometimes it's sufficient just to hint at, well, we might tap them. So it's already sufficient to depress the oil market. Of course, the oil price is important for the overall inflation rate, right? Because it's a cost factor in the economy. So an increased oil price would reduce overall production, so you get inflationary pressure, and greater oil abundance would increase production, therefore exercise deflationary pressure. Yeah, then precious metals, we talked about this, and then other things finally such as threats of seizures, right? That's certainly also part of the negotiations between banks, between governments and insurance companies, right? You can only imagine how these talks operate, right? So they get together around the table, and then the government says, look, I mean, you can either invest voluntarily in our bonds, or we'll just confiscate, right? You get the sufficient demand. I mean, this is, of course, I say this now to the blue, but it's not baseless in the sense that there's ample historical precedent. Right? Shouldn't forget, for example, that fractional reserves, one of the main reasons why we have fractional reserves today is because governments have regularly confiscated the cash balance of the banks. It was not just the robbers, it was the government went to the banks, well, you're confiscating this. You have the money, we take it. So you can operate on a fractional reserve base. That's what they did. And you can do, I mean, they did it for banks, you can do it in the case of other financial intermediaries as well. So which means that, despite the apparently dramatic situation which we find ourselves in, I agree, it's of course very bad. But on the other hand, there's, of course, also this hyperbole that I mentioned before, right? This hypersensitivity of people go through the roof and really there's nothing big that has so far happened. There's still a long way, possibly a long way to go, depending on the political resistance that governments get. I mean, technically speaking, there are still a few things that they can pull before we run into a hyperinflation. Right? And that's, of course, the ultimate weapon. that governments have, relying on the printing press to finance their expenditure. But it's really, it's the ultimate means, because as soon as you get into hyperinflation, you're done. There's nothing. I mean, you have fun for a few months, and then that's it. So you want to prevent this, and really this is the last ace that you have in your sleeve. So you do all kinds of other things before. Therefore, all this talk about hyperinflation is a little premature. Okay, conclusions, political implications, economic implications, cultural implications. Very briefly, well, the political implication, of course, that governments are much bigger due to these techniques than they would be in an orderly, I don't say a free anarcho-capitalist society, we don't talk about this, but even a halfway state of law, right, as it was the ideal in the 19th century, right? So government is bound by the law and operates with money, gets through taxation. If it needs more resources, well, it needs to find consent in parliament to increase taxes and so on, right? So we are very far off. And in fact, the power of government is much bigger than we see it in the official accounts, right? If you just look at the government budget and even government debt, right? We are always complaining about banks holding shadow households, right? Shadow budgets and so on, right? Various things you cannot see where else they are invested and so on, where else they what else they control. I mean, that certainly applies to governments, and I haven't studied this historically, but my guess is that actually the precedent probably comes from governments. We're probably the first who created shadow households to hide this control that they exercise over the economy from parliamentary control, is my guess. Research hypothesis. Right. So the political power of governments is greatly reinforced and much larger than it appears according to conventional measures of government importance. The economic implications are that, of course, we have here a very big machine to impoverish our economies, because most of this expenditure that is financed in this way is non-productive. This is consumer expenditure. Even in the case of so-called infrastructure investment of government, so we have consumer durables in that case, but it's still consumer goods by essence. And so we are impoverishing our society by diminishing its capital base. Another economic aspect that is noteworthy is the illusion that is being created among savers. And of course, many people have been waking up for this in the past 20 years or so. And they looked at the accounts and, well, I mean, how do they ever want to pay this back? This cannot work, and so on. So they started out ways of protecting themselves by not relying on public pension schemes, but developing your own old age finance, some other ways, investing money, investment funds, or buying real estate, and so on. Right? So the sound advice that I would give to any European participant here was to say, well, any money that is sunk into the public pension scheme is just lost. I mean, you have to consider this as some sort of a tax, right? You will never see this money again, right? This is the only way not to fall prey to illusion. But many people are having exactly this attitude, right? So, and then finally, we have the cultural implications. The cultural implications result from, well, government dominance on the one hand, but then also from the financialization of economic life, which results to a very large extent from this inflationary culture that I describe in my book, The Ethics of Money Production. Right? So finance plays an exaggerated role in society, but also in individual considerations and so on. And of course, associated with this, the power that comes through the centralization of finance around a few big market participants, ultimately all controlled by political players such as the central bank, and the associated dependence on the political apparatus and the associated fragility of all those who go into much debt. Yeah, so this is a little bit so what I'm doing, my current research and writing, and I, well, there are a few others who have started working on this, Mr. von Leer is one of them. I have a few doctoral students who are working on this. Philip Bargos is working in the same area. So, but there's a lot of work to be done, especially since right our starting point is the currency school perspective, and so we need to challenge the mainstream, I think, both on empirical grounds, but especially on theoretical grounds, right, where we are fundamentally opposed to the interpretation of the role that financial markets play in today's economy and society. Thank you for your attention.